He's not even a lawyer and he's kicking your ass.
No! Bad lawyer! I need a loophole!
He's not Judge Judy, an executioner!
He is!
Sorry, but my mother always said if you can't say anything nice, don't say anything at all.
Will that hold up in court?
No, I've tried it before.
Stop. Ask a question a lawyer would ask, please.
I am a lawyer.
Welcome to Opening Arguments, the podcast that pairs an inquisitive interviewer with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hello and welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode 394. What is up, my amicuses? How are you doing, Amicus Andrew?
I am fantastic, Thomas, and I'm in that kind of beautiful, you know, postpartum glow of having given birth to our amicus brief yesterday, and it's amazing. So
I was gonna say it's probably like, you know, in college when I had to do a project or something and then got it done, and then I was thinking like, I don't know, I saw how much Andrew worked on this. It's probably all my college essays combined into one, and then finishing that.
We'll talk about it, and I think we're gonna talk about both the merits and the process. I think you have an idea on that. So
yeah, it's such a shame though, because when we end up using mine instead, like it's kind of for nothing. But hopefully you've still learned a lot along the way. You know,
that's really all that counts. Yeah. You know.
How's it going, everybody? Things are crazy still, but we've got the Amicus show for you. We're going to talk all about that. If you haven't seen Andrew's amazing Amicus brief, make sure you check it out on internets everywhere. I don't know. It's up many places. We posted it everywhere. And we're going to talk a little bit about that. And we have a we have a wild card. G. Zachary Terwilliger strikes back. So I hope we get to that. People, did you see that people were posting? What was it? People saw G. Zachary Terwilliger on something and they said, oh, I thought you guys made him up.
Yeah.
No, you don't make, one does not simply make up G. Zachary Terwilliger. No one's creative enough for that. So that's our show. But before that, I know you want to say some things in the pre-show.
Yeah. And I suspect you want to add some as well. Look, I'm the optimist prime on the show. I am cautiously optimistic about the way in which real grassroots protests have driven the conversation and, you know, maybe move the needle forward a little bit over the last 2 weeks with respect to police brutality and Black Lives Matter. And you have, you know, career old white Democrats talking seriously about things like, you know, defund the police, right? And it's hard to imagine a month ago, you know, that being the kind of position that would not have been relegated to the fringes. So I think it's important that we start off kind of acknowledging that this is, you know, if you're out there and, you know, you have hopefully, you know, safely socially distant, but if you've been a part of this, like that, this seems to have started a real process, and keep doing that.
Yeah.
Like, you know,
Andrew, isn't it weird that all of a sudden when the cops stop showing up to these things, armed to the teeth, in riot gear, you know, just like gunning for battle, like the orcs in Helm's Deep or whatever it is, you know, like in some sort of orc army. Once they stop doing that, all of a sudden there wasn't as much violence at these protests.
There wasn't violence.
It's almost like it was more about the police showing up ready for battle than it was about the peaceful protesters. Isn't that something?
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's right. So look, we have gotten questions about, you know, qualified civil immunity and some of the political solutions that are being debated at this point. Here's the way that I would summarize that. Nancy Pelosi has said the House is like about to adjourn today, right? And they're going to return on June 25th. Nancy Pelosi has said that they will have that the House will pass a police reform bill at that point. The Republican-controlled Senate, which is full of insane monsters, will head to a showdown. So, and that showdown is going to be over probably everything that's in the bill. And it will be, I think, a really, really crucial test of the efficacy of this moment. If Republican lawmakers, you know, continue to take, and again, I'm looking at a quote from Jim Jordan, right? I know he's in the House. He's not in the Senate, right? But like, Jim Jordan has taken the Trump position, right? Like, oh, this is how are our communities going to be safe without the police, right? Like, and it is so demonstrably tone deaf the way to make that tone deaf is, you know, to continue to be out there and active and making it uncomfortable for, you know, mainstream Republicans and centrist Democrats who, you know, have been a go along to get along all this time. So keep doing what you're doing. We're not talking about that this week because we don't know how the law is shaping up. But like, obviously, you know, this is the story of our time right now. And you guys should be proud of yourselves for being out there and making a difference.
Yeah, I saw a joke that was like, in the future, historians are going to ask which quarter of 2020 they specialize in.
Yeah,
it's the story of our time right now, even though
right
we
now,
had 780 of those in the last 3 years. Yeah, no, but absolutely. And you know what made the difference was all the protests and everything that people said, you know, wasn't a good idea. Or they said, like, you're disqualified because as soon as one single person did any act of looting or violence, and that somehow disqualified the whole movement. Turns out, no, that's not true. And this is working everywhere. But like, one thing that cynical Thomas Negatron has learned throughout doing the show with you is that the system doesn't just fix itself. Like, things don't just do themselves. Like, we have to put constant pressure, because one thing that I'm worried about is all these stories we're seeing of officers suspended right now. Like, in all of these little interactions, we've seen video of officers doing horrible things, obviously criminal assault on protesters. And you see, like, oh, they're suspended. I just wonder how much of stuff like that, as a sort of a microcosm of the whole thing, how much of that will be, let's wait till stuff dies down a little, and then we'll just, you know, you're fine. You can come back, and it'll be fine. I don't know. I'm not saying that's what's going to happen, but it seems to be kind of the pattern that goes on in policing, and I take that as a mini example for everything. Like, once we take our eye off this, stuff will just go back to how it was. Like, that just seems to be how things work, unless we keep the pressure up for, you know, ever or long enough until some real change is made.
This is going to be one of those episodes where, you know, Optimus and Negatron like team up to, you know, fire the particle accelerator out into space or whatever. Like, I agree with that, right? Like, it I think you struck the right balance, right? Like, there is always a danger, and political science research confirms this. There is always a danger in feeling as though the protest, or even worse, right, like writing the angry takedown on Twitter or Facebook, right, that releases kind of a little dopamine hit, right? And you're like, oh, well, you know, now I've done my civic activism, mm-hmm. right? And like, yeah, the protests aren't valuable in and of themselves. Fighting with somebody on Twitter isn't valuable at all, even though, you know, we all do it. But what is valuable is continuing to keep up the pressure and continuing to change minds in a variety of ways, right? And so, you know, so I stand by the optimism of 2 minutes ago, but I also endorse 100% of what you've said, right? Which is it's super, like, if you feel like you're pacified and it's gone away, that's a mistake, and that will enable the white power structure, the white comma power the
white
structure.
Power, power structure.
Look, I mean, you know, we have actual white power nationalists in government, but like I do want to distinguish, right? Like, you know, not everybody is Stephen Miller. Yeah.
And to that point, a lot of this reform needs to happen in places that are heavily democratically controlled. And
yep.
And honestly, there are places where they elected Democrats who want to fix things, but it's such a powerful police union and the system is so rigid that they can't. So it takes a lot. It's not all cartoon racists, you know, some of it is, but it's a lot of it is just systemic.
Yep. I agree 100%. I think the key word there was systemic. And if you want to root out systemic injustice, you need systemic change. And to do that, you need a sustained active movement that is not just sort of driven by, like, I'm mad now, but that has boots on the ground building infrastructure that can actually make that happen.
I just want to throw out there too, as we're coming to a close on this part. My particular favorite thing that I've seen is Eight Can't Wait. Have you seen that?
No, I haven't seen
it. It's research based. Like, it turns out there are very, very simple reforms that would reduce, that studies show would reduce police violence if all of them are done by, like, I don't know, 72% or something. And there's stuff that is totally, you would think, would already be the case. You know, it's exhaust all alternatives before shooting, require all use of force to be reported, ban chokeholds, establish use of force continuum, require de-escalation, duty to intervene, ban shooting at moving vehicles, and require warning before shooting. Require warning before shooting. Stuff that you would think, like, wait, isn't that just how police works? Like, shouldn't that all be default? That should all be default. But no, it's not. And, you know, studies show that the departments that have these policies kill significantly fewer people. It's very simple. It's not even stuff that, like, would have to seem radical to your Republican family. You know, like, if I told this to my family, if I ever talked to them, it would, you know, I'm pretty sure I could get them to agree on this, unless they're just full gone fascist now. I don't know. We'll see. I'll let you know when we have family gatherings again. But it's very simple. So 8can'twait.org is the website. I find it very convincing. And if you're looking for something to support that might actually, you know, that'll make a tangible difference, I think that's a good place to go.
All right. Well, that makes sense to me. So.
All right, and now it's time to get to happier things, which is opening arguments, first ever amicus brief. I'm so happy about this. Everybody, round of applause for Andrew, because he worked incredibly hard. And Morgan Stringer, by the way, and is there anybody else that contributed to that missing?
Yeah, our legal intern, Rich Gilliland.
Okay, well, thank you so much for the very, very hard work on the amicus. Believe me, guys, every single time I'd message Andrew for the last, I don't know, month or two. What, how long has it been? I can't tell.
It's been 2.5 weeks, but it feels like, you know, the entirety of the Trump administration. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And I'm just so excited. We're opening arguments. It was on an amicus brief. It's so cool. Okay. So what did we want to talk about regarding the brief today?
Yeah. So I thought I would kind of break down exactly why we got involved, why it matters, some of the collateral circumstances around this, which I think are really, really encouraging. And then also, you know, Thomas, you and I were talking before the show, and I think what we're going to do is do a, like, behind the scenes as a Laud Awful Movies this month.
Yeah, Laud Awful Amicus. Laud Amicus.
Laud movies. Great Amicus. Yeah. but yeah, so I realized, you know, we've kind of done this piecemeal, and a lot of our listeners, you know, have some idea of what an amicus brief is, but we shared the drafts out to patrons, you know, in particular over the last week. And I can't tell you the number of, you know, patrons and show listeners who have written back and have said, like, well, hey, this, you know, a lot of this looks good, but like, what exactly is this doing? You know, like, what's going on? So, good question. And sometimes, you know, I forget that not everybody knows what an amicus brief is supposed to do. So, so let's talk about intervening in a case, right? In a normal lawsuit, or in a normal, and especially in a normal criminal prosecution, we know, right, that there's a constitutional prescription that courts don't render advisory opinions. They don't, like, tell you, hey, this would be a good idea. They resolve actual controversies between real people. But sometimes people have interests in a case even when they're not a party, right? And then there are two mechanisms that are available to you. The first is you can intervene in a case. And here's the classic way in which you would intervene, in which I have intervened on behalf of clients, right? Like, I represent businesses, and sometimes I represent them in contact, in the context of having bid on government contracts, right? And so imagine, Thomas, you've got a small business. I'm your lawyer. You've bid for a government contract, and they awarded it to G. Zachary Terwilliger instead.
Again.
Right? That guy.
He keeps getting me.
Yeah. And then, so you engage me, and we sue the state of California. Let's say it was a California state contract, and I get some local counsel in California. We sue the state of California, and we say, look, we want you to overturn the state's contract with G. Zachary Terwilliger. At that point, the parties to the lawsuit are the state of California and Thomas Smith, or whatever your business entity is called, Thomas Smith Enterprises, LLC. G. Zachary Terwilliger really, really cares about the outcome of this lawsuit, right? Because if we win and we get it thrown out, he's going to lose that, you know, contract that he got with the state. So G. Zachary Terwilliger could move to intervene. Other people who could move to intervene might be some of the other bidders who took part in the process, right? Like, suppose it was the case that a dozen contractors submitted bids and, you know, Thomas Smith Enterprises finished 12th, right? Not only would the winner, who you're challenging, have an actual interest in the outcome of the case.
I'd be like that white girl who claimed that affirmative action was why she didn't get into college, and then you find out she's like a D-plus student. And you're like, I would, if it weren't for G. Zachary Terwilliger and the 11 other businesses ahead of me, I would have gotten that contract.
Yeah, right. But look, like, suppose you have a legitimate, like, I've actually, it's not quite 12th out of 12, but I've actually represented a client in a situation like this, where what we said was, look, what the relief that we want is rebid the contract and exclude the guy who came in and put his thumb on the scale. And right. If you do that, we're not saying we're definitely going to win, but we are saying that guy should definitely lose, right? Nice. So you could imagine how the other 10 contractors in between, you know, the winner and Thomas Smith, might all have an interest in appearing as well. So that's when you get to intervene. An amicus brief is the next step down from that, right? It is to say, look, we don't have a direct interest in the outcome of this case, but we care about how it comes out. And that's why the first section I shared out with patrons, and the first section of the brief is a section called Interest of Amicus Curiae. And what you have to do is you have to tell the court, like, hey, this is who we are, and this is why we care. And I'm proud of our interest segment. We'll, you know, we'll break it down when, you know, when we
I
do
shed
the behind
tear
the scenes.
When I was reading that. It was very inspiring. I liked it. It was great.
Well, good. And so, you know, that is typically how the same kind of interest that we express is typically how, you know, good government groups get involved in cases, right? They will say, hey, we have a traditional strong interest in ensuring government accountability, and this is a case about record keeping. And so, you know, even though it doesn't directly affect us in the sense of having a monetary stake in the outcome, we have a philosophical stake in the outcome. And so I want to tell you, like, again, this is a criminal prosecution of Michael Flynn. Well, criminal sentencing. He's already pled guilty twice. It's rare. And by rare, I mean, I have never seen amicus present in a criminal case. It's so rare that every brief that was filed had to be corrected by the court on the record. And here's what I mean by that. I have appeared as amicus before, and I have moved to intervene in a case before. And as everyone knows, right, I do civil, not criminal litigation. And so when you go to electronically file your amicus brief in a civil case, what you can do is create a new party and a new association, right? So I pull up a case. It says, you know, Thomas Smith plaintiff versus, you know, Puzzle in a Thunderstorm LLC defendant. And I look at the affiliations and I can create a new, you know, Andrew Torres third party, right? And that's how you file your amicus brief. You create a new party and a new association, and you file under yourself. In a criminal case, that add new party section is grayed out. You can't do it. And the reason that you can't do it is really obvious, right? Like, there are only two parties in a criminal case in you know, the majority of circumstances, right? There's the government prosecuting you, and there's the defendant, right? And so, you know, so you don't have this, like, space for other people to get involved, because it's not about you. It's about the relationship between the government and the defendant. So what I had to do, and what every other amicus filing had to do, was pick one of the parties to file under. I picked the court-appointed amicus, John Gleason. But some people picked Michael Flynn. Some people picked the United States. And then the clerk had electronically had to move the case from under that association. And that actually generates a little docket entry that says errata, notice of, you know, corrected filing. I pass on that anecdote, not to sort of go through, you know, the filing aspect. I apologize. But to emphasize how truly unique it is to be filing an amicus, for anybody to be filing an amicus brief in a criminal, in a district court trial of a criminal case, right? You know, sometimes
it's almost like what they're trying to do is unprecedented and shouldn't be done, maybe.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. So Judge Sullivan set a scheduling order and solicited outside amicus in this case, and also appointed, we're going to talk about this, retired Judge John Gleason as a court-appointed amicus. And basically, Gleason was appointed to oppose the government's motion, right? Because without doing that, nobody would have opposed it, right? The government moved to dismiss, and the defendant says, yes, please, thank you, may I have another? And there would be no argument to the contrary, but for the court appointing an outside party to scrutinize this. And that is, we've talked about this on the show, within the context of these kinds of cases, which are rare, it then becomes commonplace for the court to solicit outside information. Because again, you know, the court, this is an adversarial system, right? Like the court wants to read a bunch of opposing briefs and figure out, you know, who's lying to it the least. So so that's why the court appointed John Gleason. I anticipated that dozens, perhaps hundreds of people would file amicus briefs in this case.
Yeah, I would have thought so too. I mean, for one, how many legal podcasts are there? There's got to be a lot of those. And then also just normal law people.
Yeah, that didn't happen. As it turns out, there were a grand total of 8 amicus briefs were filed in this case. And of those 8, 5 were pro Flynn. We're going to talk about the only non-crazy one of the bunch in a minute. But of the ones that were arguing that perhaps the court ought not to grant the government's motion to dismiss, there were only 3 briefs that got submitted, in addition to the court-appointed amicus brief, which is really an opposition. And those 3 were us, an outfit called Steady State, which is a group of former intelligence community professionals that basically wrote in to talk about the facts and to say, you know, the stuff that Flynn did here is super duper bad. Don't forget about that.
Yeah. And then the other one's like the Serial podcast or
no,
rivals there are.
Yeah, yeah, it's not Serial. It's not
Joe Rogan.
That would be great. The other amicus filed 4 hours late because I guess that's how Jerry Nadler rolls.
Oh, that's why you told. Okay, I was so confused because I thought you told me there were only 2, but I guess we got a late arrival. Gotcha.
The third one that came in, you would say under the wire, except way over the wire. Was a brief by the House Judiciary Committee that makes the argument of sort of putting this in the larger context of how Bill Barr is stonewalling the House, right? And that's all true, but none of these briefs really address the main point that we make in our brief, and this is, and again, we'll talk more about this in the breakdown. It is good practice when you are filing an amicus brief and you haven't been appointed by the court, right, to take a narrow area and say, I want to talk to you, judge, about this area because this is the area I care about and this is the area where you need a deep dive.
Yeah. Right? Sounds like a job for the taint team.
I did. I mobilized the taint team. And our area was just pages 10 to 11 of the government's motion to dismiss, right? Not any of the facts, not any of the justification, not how this fit in with it, but just the section that says, hey, the government is bringing this motion to dismiss pursuant to Rule 48A of the Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure, and here's the guidelines to the court when the government does that sort of thing. That's what the government said in its motion to dismiss. And when I looked at that, I looked at that and realized they were grossly overstating the law and doing so in a way that you would not do if you expected your motion to be contested, right? Because it's super easy to look at it and say,
get away with it.
They thought they could get away with it. And that's the thesis of our brief, right? Is, hey, the government is trying to tell you that they file motions to dismiss all of the charges against defendants who plead guilty all the time. And the reality is they never, ever do that. They have literally never in the course of human events in the 230 plus year history of our nation the prosecutor, the government, has never come forward and moved to dismiss all charges against a defendant who has pled guilty. So with that in mind, then we made two arguments in the brief, right? We argued, number one, that under the rule, they can't do this. And then we argued, number two, even if they can do this, that this court, that Judge Sullivan should either rule that this would not be in the public interest, or should conduct additional fact finding to figure out why this is in, whether this is in the public interest. And the example that I gave in the amicus brief was the court has the power to bring in the former line prosecutor, Brandon Van Grack, right? He's the guy who's been in charge of prosecuting Flynn this whole time, right? And when Bill Barr directed Tim Shea to file the motion to dismiss all charges against Michael Flynn, Brandon Van Grack withdrew from the case that same day, right? Like, it was not like the ink was not yet dry on the electronic filing when Van Grack was like, I'm out of here, guys. I think Judge Sullivan would very much like to know why Mr. Van Grack withdrew from this case. And he's empowered to find that out. So that's our brief. Again, we did that. And I will tell you, as good as Gleason's brief is, and it's great, ours is consistent with and supplements the arguments that they make in there. Nobody has quite made the same set of arguments in the same way that we did in our brief. So I said this at the time, we worked our asses off in terms of getting this done. But I feel like, you know, there's a real chance to do some real good in this case. And again, look, like, that real good is what this show is about, right? The rule of law. Michael Flynn is headed towards minimal jail time, potentially even probation, even if Judge Sullivan denies the government's motion to dismiss. But denying that motion to dismiss will tell President Trump, you can't backdoor your way to a pardon. You want to pardon Michael Flynn? We can't stop you from that. But don't pretend like, oh, well, this is just a thing that the lawyers had to do and it exonerates witch hunt, you know, no. Go out there and say, I want this guy who was my full-throated, lock-her-up, would-be national security advisor who secretly met with Russian agents prior to my being inaugurated and then lied to the government about that. I want that guy to go free. You got to make that case in public.
Well, plus, and this would be, I think, the first thing that Bill Barr didn't just get to do. Like,
yeah,
you know, like, have we ever had a victory against Bill Barr, the dinosaur from that TV show, the baby, not the mama dinosaur from the current. By legal standards,
It is current by legal standards, and it is so
McBeal by at least 10 years or so.
Yeah, it is so dead on though that he is the baby from dinosaurs.
But for real, we haven't. He just wins everything. He's the most competent evil person that there is.
Yeah,
I think.
Yeah, he's the Lex Luthor of
maybe
Trump's,
Mitch McConnell. He and Mitch McConnell.
Yeah, he and Mitch McConnell. Mitch McConnell is Brainiac, and Bill Barr is Lex Luthor. So, it derailing that strategy also has value. So, let me tell you then about a surprising brief that was filed. And it was an amicus brief filed by the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, and it was captioned "In support of defendant," right? In support of Michael Flynn. I want to tell you that caption is a little bit misleading. This brief in support of Michael Flynn, ostensibly in support of Michael Flynn, mentions Michael Flynn once. right? So if you do a control F and look for Flynn in the brief, which is the first thing that I did, you get two references, but one's from the caption, right?
What about like defendant or something? They don't do one of those things where they,
I went through that too. But so one's in the caption, you know, which you have to do, because you have to tell the court what case you're filing this in. And the other is at the end of the interests paragraph, which says in its entirety that defendants should not be threatened with perjury or contempt of court for recanting their plea bargains. And then the sentence is NACDL therefore files this brief in support of defendant Michael T. Flynn. That's it. throughout the rest of the brief, capital D defendant referring to Michael Flynn does not appear. So
well, what are they
you
talking
might say,
about? Is it like QAnon stuff? Or?
No. Here's what the brief is about. And look, like there is much in this brief that I can endorse, but it's manifestly inapposite in this case. So here's their concern. And I wanted to give this a hearing because there's an underlying valid point. The argument that Gleason makes and that I make, that opening arguments, that this podcast makes, we do it in a corporate way.
Too.
Yeah. Is you shouldn't be looking at this as the prosecutor withdrawing a case because Michael Flynn, the defendant, has already pled guilty twice. He's reaffirmed it in open court under exhaustive questioning from two different judges, right? So that's way different than before trial or even at trial, where the defendant has maintained his innocence and you're saying, oh, well, you know, now guess what? We've decided that we're going to drop those charges. Congratulations, you're vindicated. And that is, I think, a really intuitive and straightforward argument supported by, you know, 24 pages of legal citations. NACDL's argument is, and again, they have a point here, that you can be innocent, but nevertheless plead guilty because of the way in which our system works, right? And sure. So they begin by talking, we've talked about
I'm
plea
sure
bargains before.
Poor Michael Flynn was railroaded by the system.
That's right. Look, like, and I'm going to talk
couldn't
about why
afford a lawyer.
Yeah,
didn't
yeah.
know
he
what
had
was
he
going
had Covington
on.
And Burling. He was paying my old buddy Rob Kellner $1,500 an hour. Right? Yeah. Like, I mean, yeah, it's.
I'm pretty sure he knew what he was doing.
He knew exactly what he was doing. But I can understand a group saying most criminal defendants aren't Michael Flynn, and you know, then sort of documenting, hey. So we should caution against overly broadly saying, oh, well, you know, you've pled, therefore you're guilty, and make a per se rule. And I would tell you, like, to me, that fits nicely with the argument we make in our brief, which is let's do this on a fact specific basis. Right. Like, yeah, there are plenty of reasons to think that lots of defendants who plead guilty to avoid what the NACDL calls the trial penalty. And, you know, and again, we've talked about that. That is, you get charged with every offense that they can think of, and then they offer to plead you to a much lower offense, right? And they say, okay, like, it looks, you know, we're gonna charge you with second-degree murder. We're going to let you plead to third-degree manslaughter. And if you did neither, but, you know, you were at the scene and like circumstances look suspicious or whatever, you might look at that and go, gosh, the difference between life imprisonment without parole and pleading guilty right now and taking 7 years in jail, like, you know, I'll take the plea deal even though I'm innocent. And in fact, you know, we've talked about on the show the concept of the Alford plea. It's one of the worst Supreme Court decisions, you know, of all time, ratified the idea that you could rationally plead guilty to avoid the death penalty, even though you maintain your innocence. So their argument makes two points. That is the first of their argument. The second part of that argument that is kind of contingent is you might recall that the order appointing John Gleason as amicus also said, and hey, by the way, advise this court on whether we should bring perjury charges against Michael Flynn for lying to us. Gleason says, no, you shouldn't bring a separate. You could hold him in contempt for perjury, right? Like, you don't need a prosecutor. You don't need to specifically file charges. The court has the inherent contempt powers to say that perjury interferes with the administration of justice, because it does. And you could do that. But, Judge, we think the wiser course here is take into account his perjury when you're sentencing this guy, which I thought was pretty genius.
Yeah.
The NACDL also responds to that argument, and they say you should not consider perjury a contempt of court when you were talking about recanting a guilty plea, right? And again, in the abstract, I'm totally on board with that concept, right? Here, Flynn recanting his guilty plea is ridiculous. And in the context of sort of no good deed going unpunished, you might recall that in addition to the district court trial of Michael Flynn, in which the government's motion is pending, there is also a DC Circuit appeal. And the reason for that is when Judge Sullivan did not immediately grant the government's motion to dismiss, Sidney Powell, again, on the short list of one of the dumbest lawyers in America, Sidney Powell, representing Michael Flynn, immediately filed an amicus petition in the D.C. Circus.
D.C. Circus.
I'm not even – the circus is on my mind. Not even going to have Brian correct that, but I misspoke. She did not file an amicus petition. She petitioned for a writ of mandamus.
I'm pretty sure that's a lawyer joke that kills. More like the D.C. Circus of a
– Yeah. She immediately went to the D.C. Circuit and said – oh, you have to grant mandamus, and that mandamus is tell Judge Sullivan he has no discretion to entertain whether or not to dismiss the case under 48A. He's got to do it right now. We could have also, I will tell you, the Watergate prosecutors intervened at the D.C. or filed an amicus brief at the D.C. Circuit. We could have filed in that case as well. I did not because
too much work.
Writing amicus. Well, seriously, writing amicus briefs is hard. We would have had to have written a second brief. And even though it would have drawn largely from the first one, it would have been a lot of additional work. And we would have had to have done it earlier. And this argument is terrible. So I don't think, look, it's going to be 2-1 because Naomi Rao is on the panel, but they're going to lose, and they're going to lose hard. And the way in which you can tell they're going to lose hard, I'm going to link this in the show notes. Sidney Powell's brief is one of the stupidest non-Jay Sekulow pleadings I have ever read, right? Like it is just retelling the same like QAnon version of Michael Flynn that she's been trying to peddle before Judge Sullivan. And I'm telling you, Wilkins and Henderson, who are the other two judges on the panel, don't want to hear this nonsense.
Do these people know they're lying, or do they actually believe this, or they just don't care? I really want to know.
I can't tell either. I can tell you this. Because this is a petition for a writ of mandamus, Judge Sullivan is the respondent in this case. And I'm going to read you, this is a paragraph from page 2. This is what a pending defendant before a United States District Court judge has said about that District Court judge to the court that's up, that's next up from that District Court judge, right? And the idea that you would talk about the judge who's going to sentence you this way is something only Sidney Powell would do. So here's what she says in the brief. When the government moved to dismiss and the petitioner, that's Michael Flynn, filed his consent, respondent, that's Judge Sullivan, issued a de facto call for amici. The next day, respondent appointed amicus Gleason, who requested a briefing schedule anticipating need for time for any factual development. Petitioner promptly filed this writ. Respondent issued the order as requested, and amicus has now complied, launching a 600-page frontal assault on General Flynn and the Justice Department's motion, calling it pretextual and worse. To paraphrase Judge Posner, amicus is playing attorney general. It is no doubt a position he could fill with distinction, but it is occupied by another person, which, admittedly, that's funny, but...
Lawyer smackdown, baby.
Yeah. Respondent's unprecedented action ignores the facts of this case and defies this court's binding precedent. Respondent is not in the executive branch and, being an Article III judge, has no authority to gin up his own case or controversy where none exists. The game is over, and this court should order the umpire to leave the field. This kind of language is, throughout the brief, including a part I shared out on our the OA Twitter, in which Sidney Powell mistakenly uses the word Basque when she meant to use the word pack.
What?
So, yeah. So she says that respondent, meaning Judge Sullivan, and his Basque of amici have,
Right? Yeah, or like batch now, or something. Like,
yeah. I think it's pack because she uses pack later on. Now, I will tell you, and I posed the question this way on Twitter. I said, do you think it is either A, Sidney Powell does not know the difference between the verb Basque and the noun pack, or B, that she doesn't know the difference between those two, but is going to lie and pretend that what she really meant was to use the archaic term Basque, meaning a group of crocodiles, even though that would make no sense, right? Like you might say like pack of sharks to talk about lawyers, but like, lawyers aren't crocodiles. Crocodiles are slow, cold-blooded. It's a dumb. There's no way that this is an intentional analogy. But it is. Respondent and his amicus create a circus and will sentence an innocent man. It's just that the rhetoric is out of control. And it's a truly strategically stupid. So, yeah, I mean, from a strategic standpoint, this is just a truly stupid decision. You're going to get an angry, impassioned dissent from Naomi Rao because that's who this is aimed at. But, if you truly believe that Michael Flynn was was 100% innocent, changed his story once he got out from under the thumb of that evil Covington and Burling that forced him to plead, even though something, something, something QAnon, then you'll love this brief, but the rest of the DC circuit, I strongly predict will not. That oral argument, by the way, is while you're listening to the show, if you listen to the show when it drops on Friday the 12th. So we will soon know. And the way in which that resolution works is if mandamus is granted, then Sullivan will be instructed to dismiss the case and all of this will be for naught and the Republic will be over. If it is not, which is what I predict, then we shift back to the district court where we have filed our amicus, and the court will then decide, what am I going to do with this motion? Am I going to grant it? Am I going to hold it sub curia, which means to wait and conduct a hearing, conduct additional fact-finding? Or am I going to dismiss it outright? Am I going to say, I have enough evidence to say that that this stinks, and I'm not going to let the government come in and do a favor for a politically connected defendant. So that's what we're waiting on. That's why this matters. And I haven't, we're nearing the end of the show, and I haven't gotten a chance to like walk through how great Judge Gleason's brief is. I'm going to link it in the show notes. It's a brisk 82 pages.
On his podcast.
yeah. So it's a, you know, tidy 82 pages. I mean, read ours first, because ours is great. But I recommend reading it. And I will tell you, you know, I shared out on social media this statement, which I wish I had the guts to have said it this way in our brief. But here is the court-appointed amicus, a retired judge and practicing lawyer at Debevoise & Plimpton in New York, right? A big, big firm. Here's what he says. Quote, "The government claims that there is insufficient evidence to prove materiality and falsity," and brackets, that is, of Michael Flynn's false statements, right? "But even giving it the benefit of every doubt and recognizing its prerogative to assess the strength of its own case, this contention taxes the credulity of the credulous." And the citation there, and so like, A, that language is beautiful. And then, but the citation is to a 2013 Supreme Court case dissent, Maryland versus King. And it is, of course, a Scalia dissent. So, you know, and continues, "The government's ostensible ground for seeking dismissal are conclusively disproven by its own briefs filed earlier in this very proceeding. They contradict and ignore this court's prior orders, which constitute law of the case. They are riddled with inexplicable and elementary errors of law and fact, and they depart from positions that the government has taken in other cases." Put a pin in that. And that is...
Damn it, this guy's grabbing all our headlines, Andrew.
Yep.
I should have pushed up our brief a little bit. I should have.
You should have.
Made a little flashier.
I actually punched down our brief a little bit, as Morgan will tell you when we do our behind the scenes. A lot
of awful amicuses.
but there you go. That's the status. So we're waiting. Put all of that together. That's why amicus was filed. It's why we're waiting on a ruling from the D.C. Circuit, which I expect. It's not usual for a denial to come down from the bench at oral argument, but it could, right? Like, their arguments are so bad that you could get a denial on the spot. More likely, it will take some time. And again, taking time is in the interests of the good guys here, right? Like, unlike a lot of what's going on with respect to Trump, where, you know, we want a decision yesterday. Having the court maintain jurisdiction over this case, if that got pushed out until after Trump loses the 2020 election, that'd be a good thing rather than a bad thing, right? That this is a case where they want to get in under the wire and move to dismiss with prejudice so that Michael Flynn can never be charged, never be convicted, and never serve any time for having sold out his country. And that's why I care, and that's why this matters. So there you go. We're waiting on the D.C. Circuit. If the D.C. Circuit denies mandamus, it will go back to Judge Sullivan. And then we'll get to see if Judge Sullivan, I have it on good authority. I am 2 degrees of Kevin Bacon from Judge Sullivan. So I talked to somebody who talked to one of his clerks, and that person assured me that that Judge Sullivan will definitely read our brief. Awesome. So there you go. We'll look, we'll see, and maybe it makes a difference. Cautiously optimistic.
I can't wait. Hey, but seriously, everybody, we're going to do a full Lot Awful Amicuses, discuss the behind the scenes. I'm going to read you guys my amicus. And I think we still may be able to get that in instead. I'm sure we can do a switcheroo. You know?
Yeah, well, absolutely. I mean,
we'll put it to a vote. We'll put it to a patron vote. You know, and then I imagine we could just swap the file out wherever. We'll figure it out. Anyway, I'm going to read my amicus. We're going to have Morgan on to help give the behind the scenes. That'll be, I know we didn't do a lot of awful movies, but it was because Andrew was toiling away at this 7 billion billable hour task. So thanks everyone's patience on that, patrons, but we're going to make it up to you very soon. We have the date scheduled, coming at you fast. Patreon.com/law. Opening Arguments is brought to you by Policy Genius. With everything going on right now, a lot of people are asking if it's even possible to buy life insurance at all. Well, the answer is yes, you can buy life insurance during a pandemic. And if you have loved ones, and depending on your income, you probably should. I have noted before, I did this, not now, I did it like a year ago or more, I can't even remember, but I'm so glad I did. The world is very unpredictable, as we're seeing, and stuff happens, and I, for one, am very glad that I have a policy and that my family is protected. As an insurance marketplace, Policy Genius is in contact with the life insurance companies on their platform every day. They're keeping track of all the changes in the market so you don't have to, which means they can get you covered quickly and for the best price. Here's how it works. Policy Genius compares quotes from the top life insurance companies in one place. It takes just a few minutes to compare quotes from the top insurers to find your best price. This doesn't just save a lot of legwork. You could save $1,500 or more a year by using Policy Genius to compare life insurance policies. Once you apply, the Policy Genius team will handle all the paperwork and all the red tape for free. So if you hit any speed bumps during this application process, they'll be there to take care of everything. So if you're one of the many people looking to buy life insurance right now, but you're not sure where to start, head to policygenius.com. Policy Genius will find you the best rate and handle the process completely. They'll get you and your family protected and hopefully give you one less thing to worry about. So head to policygenius.com today.
Okay, do we have time for a wild card G. Zachary Twilliger, or...
Can we do 5 minutes? Because I really want to do that.
We can do all any right. amount of time on G. Zachary Twilliger. Go ahead.
G. Zachary Twilliger, what a clown horn of a week.
All right. So, remember, I just told you to put a pin in General Flynn's false statements, right? And you can now pull that pin out, because where that leads is that leads to our buddy G. Zachary Terwilliger, and here's how. And this is specifically, Judge Gleason says that the position that the government is taking with respect to Michael Flynn is inconsistent with the position it has taken in other cases. Here's what he means by that. So let's talk about Flynn and his business partner, Bijan Kian, Bijan Rafikian. You may or may not recall from the Mueller report that Bijan Rafikian was business partners with Michael Flynn. And collectively, they lobbied the U.S. government, including members of Congress, to try and pressure the U.S. government to release a Turkish dissident and send him back to Turkey for punishment, right? So you've got dissident here in the country receiving asylum protected by the U.S. Michael Flynn and Bijan Rafikian lobbied Congress to be like, eh, why don't you send that guy home? That, you may not be surprised to find out, is not a crime. But what is a crime is to do that and then not register with the government and say, I am lobbying on behalf of a foreign government, right? Because we want to know when our scumbags are in the pockets of foreign governments, right? And that is the Foreign Agents Registration Act. And Michael Flynn and Bijan Kian very clearly violated the Foreign Agents Registration Act. So Michael Flynn got a sweetheart deal at the very, very outset of the Mueller investigation. He was the first plea deal. We talked about it. We had our buddy Randall Eliason, whom we're overdue to have back on the case, on the show. But we had Randall come on, and I said, seems like a sweetheart deal to me. And, you know, former prosecutor and somewhat more temperate than I am, Randall Eliason, was like, yeah, this is a super sweetheart deal. And you only grant those when you think the person that you're giving the deal to can roll on somebody higher up the food chain. And so We were super excited about that when that was announced back in January. And so that was where we thought things were going, right? And that never happened because Michael Flynn fired Covington and Burling, stopped cooperating, hired Sidney Powell, started maintaining that he was innocent. And so the government, at minimum, they thought they then regrouped in the summer of 2019 and said, all right, well, this guy's not helping us with respect to redacted. And redacted, again, we have to infer, but I would infer Donald Trump Jr. at minimum, maybe the president himself. The government came back and said, yeah, not helping us out with any of those, but at least he's still going to help us in testifying against his former business partner, Bijan Kian. Will it surprise you to learn that under the guidance of Sidney Powell, Michael Flynn did not help convict Bijan Kian? It kind of went way worse than that. Not only did Michael Flynn not render, he was supposed to be the star witness, but because he started, you know, saying crazy things in public, the government was like, you know what? Hey, we're not going to call you as a witness because you're going to be a terrible witness on the stand, which he would be. All we need you to do is we need you to authenticate this one document against Bijan Kian. And Michael Flynn refused to authenticate the document.
I don't know anything about it.
Exactly. Not only did he refuse to authenticate the document, but filed an appearance in the Bijan Kian case to contest the document and intervene on behalf of the defendant, his corrupt Turkish business partner.
Still end up with a sweetheart deal then? How did it not just all go away?
It is possible that a prosecutor would have grounds to say not just that you don't get bonus points. You don't get the downward departure for cooperation, for rendering substantial assistance.
You get upward
departure
for being a clown
up,
horn.
Yeah, exactly. But blow up the deal and say, yeah, no, we want to prosecute this guy against all charges. That could happen. It's a very, very low probability event, and it would require a lot of things to fall into place. But that is potentially on the table if we get Bill Barr out as Attorney General. So, you know, that is potentially the case.
Wait, we can run out the clock that long?
I don't know that we can, but what I do know is that we certainly could run out the clock. And let's not use it that way, right? Because we're not talking about just delay. We are also talking about bringing embarrassing facts to light. And that's a possibility.
Like, for example, remember when he chanted "lock her up" when in fact he was the criminal the entire time?
Yeah, it looked like it is difficult to overemphasize just how much of a scumbag Michael Flynn is, right? We do that in our amicus brief, so go read that. So Bijan Kian, government thought, hey, you're going to be our star witness. Okay, you're at least going to help a little bit. Oh, no, you're going to obstruct us. Okay. And the prosecutor then, in the sentencing memorandum, Brandon Van Grack, described Michael Flynn's actions as, quote, remarkable and again, here's a direct quote, wholly inconsistent with the defendant assisting, let alone substantially assisting, or cooperating with the government in that case. So Michael Flynn hires Sidney Powell, tries to blow up his own plea deal, sabotages the Rafikian prosecution. As it turns out, the jury, and by the way, Rafikian is being prosecuted in the Eastern District of Virginia, not in D.C., because that's where the Flynn Intel Group was located. That's where they did all the illicit lobbying on behalf of the government of Turkey without telling the government that they were lobbying on behalf of the government of Turkey. So despite Michael Flynn mucking up the waters, The jury convicted Bijan Kian anyway. They said, yep, wow. Yeah, you violated the Foreign Agents Registration Act. However, the judge in that case then did something that very, very rarely happens. And that is he overruled the jury's verdict. And he entered a directed verdict of not guilty on the grounds that there was insufficient evidence for the jury to reach his verdict. And if you're asking yourself, does that happen? The answer is that almost never happens. And that almost never happens for, you know, a lot of good reasons. Judges are pretty reluctant to overturn jury verdicts. This is Judge Trenga. But I will tell you, leaving aside the political context, I can kind of understand why Judge Trenga did what he did, right? He looked at this case and he said, boy, the evidence is a mess, right? Usually, right, in a typical case where the prosecution says, we're going to call our star witness, Thomas Smith, and then a day later, the government's like, actually, we're not going to call Thomas Smith. And then 3 days later, when Thomas Smith pops up as a witness for the defense, you're like, all right, well, the evidence seems pretty crappy. And without Thomas Smith being able to authenticate a particular set of documents, it's pretty hard for us to move forward to a conviction. So Judge Trenga entered a directed verdict of not guilty over the jury's finding of guilty. And when that happens, a weird thing occurs. And that is this. Ordinarily, actual double jeopardy prevents the government from appealing when you get a not guilty verdict from a jury, right? So trial, the jury verdict comes back, not guilty. The prosecutor doesn't get another bite at that apple, right? You've got double jeopardy. You can only be tried once for the same offense. And that's it.
Unless you murder him on a boat, you can't. There's no other.
Unless it's on a boat, that's exactly right. And so it's done. But in a case like this, where the jury says you're guilty, but the judge intervenes over the top, you, as the prosecutor, can appeal and say to the appellate court, hey, I want you to reinstate that jury verdict.
Talk about a one weird trick.
It is indeed one weird trick. And so that's what happened, right? Jury convicts Rafikian. Judge Trenga says, no, I'm going to enter a directed verdict of not guilty. And the U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of Virginia files an appeal to the Fourth Circuit. This was filed on January 24th of this year. And we didn't cover it on the show because, you know, Rafikian, not a core player, no real connection to Trump. This is just a bad dude who cooperated with, you know, who was partners with Michael Flynn to try and, you know, compromise the national security interests of the United States.
Yeah, right? don't tell Trump about him. I'm sure he'd be like, oh, that guy sounds great. Let me just intervene on his behalf here.
Yeah, exactly. So we didn't cover it. And it was kind of a no big deal. Then the Rafikian's opposition brief was due. That was due it was actually due in March. So he got a couple of continuances. So it was due motions for extensions of time. So he filed that in mid-April. And then because you are the appellant, the United States gets to file a reply brief. And that reply brief was originally due in mid-May, but with, again, reciprocal motions for extension of time, which, you know, are sort of even more likely to be granted here during COVID-19, where, you know, it's kind of hard to get stuff done. That reply brief was not due until this Monday.
I blacked out. Wasn't this like a couple minutes on G. Zachary Terwilliger? Or are we another deep dive? I think Andrew just deep dive us, everybody.
I did, but I promise you,
this was a non-consensual deep dive. I consented to a quick wild card segment. Here we are. I got my diving boots on or whatever.
Well, since you spoiled the punchline, we'll go there now. The U.S. attorney who filed the appeal in the Bijan Kian case is G. Zachary Terwilliger. And here is the connection that this has to the Flynn case. January of 2020, the government files its brief to the Fourth Circuit saying, respectfully, Judge Trenga made a mistake. There's plenty of evidence. There's plenty of reasons to sentence Bijan Rafikian, and this court should reinstate the jury's verdict. That brief mentions Michael Flynn 126 times, right? Why does it mention Michael Flynn 126 times? I want to read you the introductory paragraph. This is why. For over 3 months, defendant Bijan Rafikian engaged in clandestine activity for a foreign government in the United States. As part of the Flynn Intel Group, Rafikian and his partner, Lieutenant General Michael T. Flynn, organized the investigation of a Turkish dissident residing in the U.S., engaged in lobbying members of Congress against him, and disseminated negative information about him in the public press. From the beginning, Rafikian and Flynn agreed to perform these activities under the direction and control of the Turkish government, which used a highly connected Turkish businessman as their intermediary. Okay? Totally straightforward, right? Rafikian and Flynn were partners. They lobbied secretly on behalf of Turkey without telling the U.S. government. That's against the law. Flynn then files his response. Rafikian. Files his response. Not going to go into that. It's a whole bunch of nonsense. Then G. Zachary Terwilliger has to file a reply brief. That reply brief was filed late Sunday night, the 7th, at like 11 o'clock at night. And the reply brief came in the space in between when the government has now completely reversed its position on Michael Flynn, right? In January of 2020, Michael Flynn was still, that was when Brandon Van Grack was filing the sentencing memorandum that said, this dude hasn't cooperated with us at all. He does not deserve a reduction in any sentencing. There was no notion that Bill Barr was going to come in and corrupt the process. By June is the time in which Barr has now come in and taken Van Grack off the case and ordered the government to dismiss out the charges against Michael Flynn in their entirety for totally pretextual and stupid reasons. So now the question is, how can G. Zachary Terwilliger maintain on behalf of, right, the United States of America in its position as the government, how can they simultaneously move forward to prosecute Michael Flynn's partner while saying in a different court at the exact same time, but by the way, Michael Flynn did nothing wrong, right? Like those positions are directly contrary. And you can see that in this court reply brief, because the original brief mentions Michael Flynn 126 times. The reply mentions him 10 times, mostly obliquely. And the most it says is this court should draw the inference that he is a co-conspirator because the government is entitled to the benefit of every inference on appeal because it is the losing party below. I strongly suspect, I've chatted with our friend AG over at Mueller. She wrote, we kind of developed this out together. This reply brief has Bill Barr's fingerprints all over it. And it is, in my estimation, Terwilliger went to Barr and said, hey man, we're still going to prosecute Bijan Kian. And Barr was like, yeah, I don't care about that guy at all. But then stopped and said, but wait, you got to let me take a look at anything before you file. And it's pretty sanitized. Again, you can't sanitize everything because it is impossible and ridiculous and will come up has already been raised by Judge Gleason that the government is, and we flagged it in our amicus as well, that the government is simultaneously prosecuting Michael Flynn's partner, but saying, oh, no, we have no reason to believe that Michael Flynn committed any crimes whatsoever. He's an innocent man. That's what Sidney Powell described him as on appeal to the D.C. Circuit. So this is what happens when you try and stop prosecutors from doing their jobs. Like, you know, it's you can push down, you know, I'm trying to think, it's the combination of the like plugging fingers in the dike and like pushing the beach ball down below the water. Some combination of that water analogy is appropriate, but like, you know, you can interfere in a lot of politically connected prosecution, but you can't interfere in all of them. And so there you go. So it is the resurfacing of our good old friend G. Zachary Terwilliger, who
he strikes again.
We shall
have our revenge on G. Zachary Terwilliger.
He just, and again, right, Terwilliger, lifelong Republican, right? Like, no, not a friend of the show in that sense. But you can see somebody who just wants to, like,
well, he's like, do his job. Are we still doing our jobs at all? Or
yeah. Do we still help out?
Are we doing our jobs none or only when it's evil people that we want to bail? You know, like what level of, do I still work here? What do we do?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, that is what explained this is that, you know, and again, it's part of the larger story of if you are optimistic about the future, right? Like, Trump's put a lot of bad dudes, and they're all dudes, except for Betsy DeVos. But he's put a lot of bad dudes in a lot of position of power. But you know, you can't completely corrupt the machinery of government in, at least not in one presidential term. So, you know, let's make sure all he's got.
Well, there it is time. After that, just brief 30-second dive into G. Zachary Terwilliger, it's time to thank our patrons at patreon.com/law. It is First Timer Friday, and I hope these fine patrons enjoyed all of your amicus updates, Andrew, as well as, you know, they're going to get the lot awful amicuses if they're at the right level there. And I will start us off. I would like to thank Judge Sullivan should take legal advice from this podcast. Nice. Very on theme there. James Allen, Eric Denton, Brendan O'Brien, Alex Dory, Lee Thompson, Jessica, Nicole, Great Dooku Tree. Oh, that's from Zelda, isn't it? I think that's from Ocarina of Time, I'm pretty sure. Kyle Sherman, Adam Snyder, Jessica Wolf. What do you call a lawyer with an IQ of 50? A congressman. Teresa C. Timlin. Returning patron says Black Lives Matter. We do as well. BG. James Staunton. Sarah Bright. Julius Parishi. Larry Johnson. David Clancy. J.S. Bowman. Justin Kinman. And Mark Smith. And Bryson King. Thanks so much. Your turn, Andrew.
All right, and thank you to Derek Porvaznik, to NEJC. I don't know if that's an abbreviation, but I don't think I can pronounce that as a word. But thank you, NEJC. To Justin Buchan, to Thomas Kleberg, to, hey, can we start over? I forgot to hit record. Love that. Greg Hilbert. To, I may have said that I was listening to CogDis more now because opening arguments was just too depressing me, was just depressing me too much, but I can't stay angry. Well, we can't stay angry at you either. And thanks for coming back. To that nerd from Knoxville. Yeah, I know the one. To Tat in Taos, Christopher Hazel, Tyler Gerald, to Tulsi Gabbard was the only principled liberal in the primary. Well, strong disagree on that one, but thanks for supporting the show.
Perhaps that was a patron of our show.
Intended ironically, but no, thanks. To Hagbird Celine, Dan, to Firkin Sturf. I think that's a Swedish chef.
Sure.
To Enrico Depressi, David Clements, Leslie C. McDonough, Missile Toes. That's spelled like Missile Command, which is great. Ross Kinsey, to everyone else who's hoarding toilet paper, I've been hoarding bidets. Do you really need more than the one? To Tim Capel, to Whammo Blammo. I love that name. Saral is a Bonjwa, B-O-N-J-W-A.
No idea.
I don't know. That's not on any of my tabs.
None of the Zelda games that I can think of, so I don't know. Yeah.
And finally, fantastic Red Dwarf reference to Unpack Rachel and Get Out the Puncture Repair Kit. Thank you all so much.
Thank you, new patrons. Look forward to that lot of amicuses very soon. And now it's time for T3BE. I think I'm on a bit of a skid. Gotta get back in the...
No associate of this firm has ever failed the bar exam.
Talk to the hand. I need your clothes. That's one of my mission parameters. Trust me. I know now why you cry.
You know, it's because I focus so much on my amicus brief. I think that's the problem.
Yeah, no, it obviously, I think you should be great.
I poured my heart and soul into it, and I just, you know, it's hard to also ace the bar exam while you're doing that. People understand. Plus, I'm raising kids, you know, it's a lot.
Yeah, people do understand that. Well, fortunately, I have a real property question for you. So, okay. You know, that'll be...
So next week, everybody, maybe I can come back.
Sorry, let me save our 82 question only. And sending it to you. There you go. All right, Thomas. A landowner borrowed $100,000 from a lender and executed a valid mortgage on a commercial tract of land to secure the debt. The lender promptly recorded the mortgage.
Yeah, still don't know what that, I think, okay.
A year later, the landowner conveyed the same tract to a developer by a deed that expressly stated that the conveyance was subject to the mortgage to the lender, and that the grantee expressly assumed and agreed to pay the mortgage obligation as part of the consideration for the purchase. The mortgage was properly described in the deed, and the deed was properly executed by the landowner.
I think I would skip this one in the real test. It's not worth the time.
Yeah. However, because there was no provision or place in the deed for the developer to sign, he did not do so. The developer promptly recorded the deed. The developer made the monthly mortgage payments of principal and interest for 6 payments, but then stopped payments and defaulted on the mortgage obligation. The lender promptly instituted foreclosure procedures in accordance with the governing law. After the foreclosure sale, there was a $10,000 deficiency due to the lender. Both the landowner and the developer had sufficient assets to pay the deficiency. Now, there is no applicable statute in the jurisdiction other than the statute relating to foreclosure proceedings. At the appropriate stage of the foreclosure action, which party will the court decide is responsible for payment of that $10,000 deficiency?
I'm sure I've asked you this before, but is it like the SAT where you get a minus points for the wrong answer?
Yes, you do.
You don't want to guess.
I said that, but it's been a long, long time since I have...
I think the whole thing with SAT was you get minus like 0.25 or something. So like if you can narrow it down to 2, it's worth guessing. But if you can't narrow it down beyond, you know,
well, no, mathematically, the way the SAT worked was on a multiple choice question, you got minus a quarter. So
that's what I said. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But then it's always since one time out of 4, you'll get it right. Right. You broke even by guessing. Right. So it was always worthwhile. I'm just disputing the worthwhile to guess. Yeah. Right.
Wait, like, so why did they say that?
They always said it that way. They would say it in the instructions, like, so you should not guess. Like, but they were just trying to screw with you.
Or maybe they were saying it's not worth the time investment of doing it if you break even. Maybe that's it. Yeah. Like save test time. Anyway, the whole point is, depending on how that works. So Andrew can clear that up for me. And I'm sure that'll drastically change my score. If I've been losing points for the,
I don't think so. As I think back on it now, I think it's just number correct.
My answer to this on the real bar exam would be pick one and then just move on because it's not worth the time of reading this five paragraph essay of a question. This is the most confusing thing. This might be one of the most confusing of all of them. But setting that aside, since you took 40 minutes on a 5-minute G. Zachary Terwilliger update, I guess I can take the time to answer this question. Okay.
All right. So who will the court decide is responsible for payment? A, the developer because he accepted delivery of the deed from the landowner and in so doing accepted the terms and conditions of the deed. B, the developer because he is estopped by having made 6 monthly payments to the lender. C, the landowner because the developer was not a signatory to the deed. Or D, the landowner because he was the maker of the note and the mortgage, and at most, the developer is liable only as a guarantor of the landowner's obligation.
Huh, interesting. Okay, landowner borrows $100,000. Executed a valid... This is all the stuff that always gets me. Executed a valid mortgage, secure the debt, promptly recorded the mortgage. Like, I don't know what that means. It'd also be like they took a picture of the mortgage, and also he wrote it down... And then he's like, what does that mean? I don't recording it. I don't know. Conveyed the same track. So the landowner is like subleasing kind of or like renting out. Conveyed the same track to a developer by a deed that expressly stated that the conveyance was subject to the mortgage to the lender and that the grantee expressly assumed and agreed to pay the mortgage. Okay, so I guess it's just like selling your house then, maybe. So instead of, instead of like selling the house and then they pay you the money and you pay off your mortgage and they take out another mortgage, this is saying, I'm going to sell you this thing of land, this commercial huge tract of land, and you're going to just take on my mortgage rather than doing the other thing I said. So the mortgage was properly described, deed was properly executed, however... For some reason, the developer didn't sign. There was no provision or place in the deed for the developer to sign. So we have an unsigned deed. Seems weird. Okay, developer made the mortgage payments and then they default or whatever. And the lender did foreclosure, blah, blah, blah. There's a $10,000 deficiency due to the lender. So it's the landowner and the developer. Both have assets, so who do they go to first? Well, okay, so we've got the no signature thing. That, I don't know, but that signatures shouldn't be magic, but then again, this is land we're talking about, so who knows, it's real property, maybe they are magic, I don't know, but if I'm just going on fairness, the developer made the mortgage for 6 months, like that tells you that they think they owe this mortgage. And so I think the developer, I'm strongly... leaning toward the developer. So, no applicable statute, it says, appropriate stage of foreclosure action. Which party will the court decide is responsible? So, I'm leaning heavily toward developer. So, A, the developer, because he accepted delivery of the deed from the landowner and in so doing accepted the terms and conditions. Or, B, the developer, because he is estopped by his having made 6 monthly payments to the lender. You know, that is one of those weird answers, and... I wonder if this time it's correct. I wonder if this is one of those questions where, yeah, like maybe you didn't sign so you could have gotten out of it, you know, like a week later or something, but you made 6 payments. You basically took on the mortgage. Ugh. I'm very tempted by B just because it's like kind of a curveball. I'll check out the landowner answers just for fun. The landowner because the developer was not a signatory. Yeah, I mean, maybe. D, the landowner, because he was the maker of the note and mortgage, and at most, the developer is liable only as a guarantor. I don't think D. I think they did a conveyance. They did a conveyance here, so I don't know. I think not D. Like I said, leaning heavily toward A and B. I think C is an okay landowner answer, but I'm leaning away from it. I'm just going to, you know, this is a stupid real property question. I'm on a skid. You know, I'm going to go with B because I think it's kind of an interesting answer here. And I think it might be right. B, the developer, because he's stopped by having made 6 monthly payments. So that's under the theory that maybe the signature thing was significant, but because, you know, the developer just took on the mortgage and made 6 payments that, you know, they're liable. So there you have it. Probably totally wrong. In the real world, I would have just guessed really quickly or not even bothered because you only get like 2 minutes a question, if that. So there you have it.
All right. And if you want to play along with Thomas, you know how to do that. Just share out this episode on social media. Include the hashtag T3BE. Include your guess, your reasons. Therefore, we will pick a winner and shower that winner with never-ending fame and fortune. Fame and fortune not guaranteed.
I wonder if it was that if you can just eliminate one answer, then go ahead and guess. Did they say that? I can't remember. It's been too long. Anyway, thanks for listening, everybody. We love you so much.
If you know what the rule is for the SAT.
Yeah, we're about to take the SAT any minute, Andrew and I. Did I ever tell you you got a perfect math SAT, Andrew, while we're on the topic?
Nice. Congratulations. Yeah,
I sucked at English, but got a perfect.
I retook trying to get a perfect math, and I never got above a 780, and it just killed me.
780, so, pretty good. So, not bad.
Yeah, but not. I defer to you in all things math from here on out.
So all right. Go. Thanks for listening, everybody. Seriously, we're recording on Saturday. Lot awful amicuses. I'm so excited. You're going to hear the real amicus brief that I've been preparing. That, you know, enough of the Andrews. And no, we'll go through the deep dive, the background of the real amicus that yeah. Andrew and Morgan and Rich worked on. So thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you then.
You betray the law!
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it'd be a big help if you could leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @openargs. Until next time. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC. All rights reserved.
Opening Arguments is a copyrighted production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC, all rights reserved. Opening Arguments is produced with the assistance of our editor, Brian Ziegenhagen, our transcriptionist, Heather Leverage, production assistant, Ashley Smith, and with the generous assistance of our volunteer unofficial researcher, Deborah Smith. Special thanks to Teresa Gomez, who runs our merch and our live shows and also heads up the OA Wiki project. Follow them at OA Wiki. And a big thank you to our Facebook group moderators, Emily Waters, Alicia Cook, Eric Brewer, Natalie Newell, Brian, and Teresa. Check out the Opening Arguments community on Facebook. And finally, thanks to Thomas Smith for creating the fabulous OA theme song, which is used with permission.